Give a short introduction to Sylvie Peicher. She's currently an Emeritus Fellow in Mathematical Physics, and she studied in Paris and did her PhD at the Ruhr University in Bochum and at one of the universities in Paris, which are numbered through, so it was apparently number six. And after that, she became an assistant professor at the University of Strasbourg. She moved then to, and now it's Clermont, Auvergne, and was also delegated to the CNRS. But since 2011, she decided to move to Germany, to the University of Potsdam, where I'm also studied, so I'm very happy about this qualified hiring. She was also a Humboldt Fellow, and I find that very cool. She is actually a real knight of the, so a chevalier of the Legion of Honor. Everything in French, but I don't speak French. She's very active on many social issues. She has also many connections to Colombia. But among other things, she chaired the European Women in Mathematics organization. And recently, she organized an exhibition, which is called Women of Mathematics Throughout Europe, which has been shown in more than 80 places so far. 100 places so far. Thank you.
Thank you. So you need to use a laptop, or we can bring the laptop.
Put it in my pocket, and I think I can start, or am I not supposed to start?
No, please go ahead.
Anyway, I can thank you, first of all. So thank you, Kasia, thank you, Bianca, for the invitation, also for the introduction. It's very nice. I see lots of familiar faces. It's very nice to be here with you all. So maybe I'll start slowly, because I think time is short. And so this will be a kind of very different from Renata's talk, because it'll be rather mathematical. I hope that it has something related to space-time, in the sense that I'm looking at singularities and how to deal with them. And let me start with this rather provocative question: can complement maps cure divergences? It sounds like a bit strange combination, complement maps and divergences. This is based on joint work with Pierre Clavier, who's here, who's in Berlin and Potsdam right now, Li Guo, who is at Rutgers University, and Bing Zhang, who is at Sichuan University in Chengdu. So thank you so much. Why do we have to do this?
This is very interesting.
It seemed to work.
Oh, this is for the pointer.
Yeah. Thank you. Ah, but now you see, I have the problem again. I hope I won't be missing something underneath. You see, it looks as though it's cut off. That was what happened. You did something right now which worked with the other.
I do enter full screen.
Ah, that looks better. Thank you so much. Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Technique we've overcome. That's the main step. So I have to tell you what complement maps, complements are. You know them very well. It's just to separate something from the rest. And that we do all the time. I think that's what we do when we tidy up, when we do anything to organize. And we're going to organize divergences, so singularities. And so I'll start off with very easy things and then hopefully convince you that complements, taking complements, so separating something from the rest, is a useful device to cure divergences. So a provocative question, what does have taking a complement have to do with a particle accelerator? So they serve to separate subdivergences, to organize them, either using a coproduct, or, and this is inspired by Kohn and Keimer, or a locality relation. And they might look very different in the end, the methods we use to separate subdivergences, but they use this very same idea, separate the space into two things, one set, subset, and its complement. So, they enable us, having organized and separated subdivergences, to extract finite parts, and hopefully these finite parts have the properties we want. In particular, we'll be concerned with locality, namely, we want to preserve separation of space, which is also inherent to the concept of locality, events which are separated in space-time should be measured separately, differently. So, what are abstract complement maps? So this, I don't know what I do. I didn't really move. I'm very bad at this. I should have practiced.
Yeah.
I don't know how you did it. Oh, yeah, but it's too delicate. I think it doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
It's when I put it. Okay, I think now it's okay.
If I may, I'm yes, just going to switch it so that it's not. Go this way. Okay.
Thank you.
I think it might fall out again.
Okay. I shouldn't breathe.
No, you're fine. Just going to make sure it's seated in there well.
Okay, thank you. Let's see if I pass the test. Okay, what are abstract complement maps? We know them all. So we have think of the set complement, taking a subset of a set X and its complement, very easy. Orthogonal complement, taking a subspace in a Euclidean space and taking its orthogonal complement. You could say also taking a complement subspace in a vector space, separating the vector space into a subspace and its direct sum with its complement space. But this is very similar to a complement set, because if you think in terms of finite dimensional vector spaces, it's like taking a basis, finite basis, and its complement set in a basis of the total space. That's why I'm not naming it. So I think those are the two prototypes that we should have at the back of our mind, which come up all the time. Notice that the second one uses a specific Euclidean structure. So there's a choice there. They have in common that they stabilize the set P of X, or S of V, S for subspace, P for power set, of this, set or space we chose, which won't be always the case. We could take a complement map which takes us out of the set we're looking at. Very strange, but it does happen. And we would like to include strange complements, a conical complement. And let me just stop here to comment on this. In fact, this idea of taking complements, which is what we do, all of us have done, but focusing on that, comes from an article by Pommersheim and Garufalidis, I'll name again at some point, who used that to establish an Euler-Maclaurin formula on polytopes. It sounds very remote from this, but it's not that remote, because polytopes are intersections of cones. And they were summing on cones in order to sum on polytopes. Summing on cones, you have on discrete points of cones, you have infinitely many, you have to renormalize. So their complement maps were also to renormalize, but they didn't say it in that language. Okay, so we took, in fact, this idea of a complement map from them. A tree complement, so we'll go back to this. You take a face of a cone and take its complement. We'll go back to that. You take a subtree of a tree and take its complement, which is not a tree anymore. It could be a forest. A graph, a subgraph, that brings us back to quantum field theory, a Feynman graph. Take a subgraph, not any subgraph maybe, and take its complement in a certain sense. So we should do that at some point. Indeed, these complements will very much be inspired by those. So those are really the prototypes. Don't hesitate to ask a question if you have one along the way. So, common features. The ones we named were defined on posets with a smallest element. So we had a set, a power set, and a power set has the inclusion as a partial order, and there's the smallest element, the void set. Okay? The set of subspaces, linear subspaces of a vector space, V, and I denoted by this strange symbol to be a subspace of, is also a poset and has the smallest element, the zero element, zero subspace. Now let's take a convex polyhedral cone. So this is like an ice cream cone, but with corners, polyhedral, because rounded shapes are much more difficult to deal with. So we take it with corners, okay, with a section given by a polytope. And these are infinite cones, as cones should be. Not ice creams are not, but they should be. We consider the faces of a cone. And a face is also a cone. And to be a face of is to be, defines a partial order on faces of a cone. Okay, trees. Now we take a tree. So I won't define what a tree is, it's a certain directed graph, and we take rooted trees, so it has a root. So you can imagine a root and then branches emerging from the root. And now we're going to cut the tree at a certain level. We're going to use admissible cuts, which really separate the tree, and consider the lower part, which will still be a tree. The upper part might be a forest if we take a very general cut. So there again, to be a subtree is what we've cut off from the bottom, defines a partial order on trees. In fact, on forests. Now to be a subgraph of, so there's this PI, which let's not go into that. Let's just consider subgraphs of a graph. So these were graphs, but these were directed graphs and with a poset structure and a root. These are now graphs, you can imagine a Feynman graph. And we're going to consider subgraphs just by taking a connected or disconnected set of internal edges in gamma together with the vertices they encounter. Just a very ordinary notion of subgraph. Okay. So now I was telling you the complements we had to start with stabilized the poset we had. For a cone, it won't quite be like that. If I have... I just mean that you started in a poset and you took a complement and it was still in the POSET. Whereas now, this won't be the case. So let's see what we have. We have a cone. This is our cone, and we have a face. And now we're going to project onto the orthogonal of the face, we're going to project the whole cone. So this is using the other complement map we had, the orthogonal complement. And of course, now we're leaving the cone. So if we were considering the faces of the cone, you see that we're not stabilizing anymore. We're taking an orthogonal complement, jumping out of the cone. We're defining a cone, but we're not inside the faces of the cone. This it's called transverse cone, or at least it was called like that by Berlin and Vern, who were also looking at the Euler-Maclaurin formula on polytopes in conjunction with toric geometry, with the Todd genus. So that's the notation. You see, we're projecting onto the orthogonal of the face the cone. So we're using the orthogonal complement to define this new complement. On trees, we're taking an admissible cut. We're cutting the tree at a certain level, taking the bottom part that was the original subtree, and now taking the complement, which could be a forest. So it's the crown. Now on graphs, we're taking a subgraph and then shrinking it to a point together with the outgoing edges and taking the rest. And this remainder graph is what will our complement will be. So you see, probably some of you are familiar with this. This was introduced by Conan Kreimer, inspired by Kreimer, who had already looked at the tree structure to try to describe the structure of subdivergences in quantum field theory that you see from the forest formula. Okay.
There's a question.
Lee? Yeah?
Is this related to the negation in a Hermitian algebra?
To the what? Sorry?
The notion of a negation in a Hermitian algebra.
I don't know. We could... I'm not sure. We could talk about that, maybe. Maybe if so, after that, we could talk about it. So I quoted Garofalidis and Pommersheim. So let's now take a more general setup, take a POSET that was important, and then the set, we fix an element E in the POSET and take all the elements which are smaller than E. Okay, so it's our top element. So it's a family of maps which take us from S of E to P, but so you see this were, for example, the faces of the cone, but P could be any cone, okay? There's still, this still is a POSET, but we might have left the cone. So that's what I was telling you earlier on. And we denote it as a set complement, which is very useful, but think that it could be much more general. And what properties would we like? We'd like that the set of elements smaller than E over A, that the complement of A, be complements of A in smaller elements than the element E. Okay? Very natural. Then, this is kind of simplification rule, which is also very natural. If you think of complements, think of a quotient, and that's how it works. And then you would like that the complement of the smallest element be the whole set or space.
Sorry for asking a trivial question, but what exactly is that? The set difference are you taking?
No, I'm just denoting it like that and saying that's the rules it should obey.
Okay.
I don't know. All the ones I've given you obey these rules. And that's all I want. And those rules are very natural. Think of a complement set or think of an orthogonal complement. Okay. So now that we have complement sets, let's see what we can do with them. We're going to build coproducts, and I'll tell you why coproducts later on. So I'm cheating a bit. You should be a little more careful than I'm going to be, but I wanted to avoid technical details. So what are we going to do? We're going to take all this, the elements that are smaller than our element E, sum over it. So there's already one condition I've hidden, which is that this should be finite. Otherwise, I don't understand what I'm doing. I'll take a complement, and the tensor product with the element I started with. This defines a coproduct. So I'm sure a lot of you are familiar with the notion of coproduct. For anybody who might not be, it's kind of dual to a product. Morally, it's a bit more subtle than that. And it's to undo a product. So you can imagine that this is a kind, it's made of A's and complements of A's. And what we're doing there is separating it. Since we have a way of separating using a complement, we can do that. Most of the coproducts I've come across in the context of renormalization theory are of this type. There are some that are not of this type. For example, group elements. You take the coproduct of a group element, and it's not like that. It's G tensor with G. Okay, but the ones that we use in renormalization theory are, as far as I've met them, of this type. And this yields a co-algebra structure. So one might say, where does it come from? Co-associativity, if you remember. So these were the questions you asked. These two things will give you the co-associativity. It's a small exercise. It's very nice. And you see it's telling you what the complements are. And here it's telling you how the complements behave with each other. And this is enough to prove co-associativity. And one can guess that this is used to prove co-unit property. OK? So that's what I say here. So it's very easy. It's really because of this complement property, and the properties we singled out were very natural for complements. Now, why is a coproduct useful? So some of you know that probably even better than I do, because they're used to preserve multiplicativity. So I won't go into details, but let's see where the poset comes up and what we do with it. So we have this poset P, and so now from a theory we're going to consider, we'll take this poset into an algebra, hopefully, of meromorphic germs. I'm not telling you what they're like, but or maybe I should call it P. So from an element P, it could be a cone, it could be a tree, it could be a Feynman graph. You can implement maybe a summation procedure, an integration procedure, and end up with a meromorphic germ. You might ask, where do the complex variables come in? It's because you've regularized your map, which a priori gives you a divergent integral, divergent sum. You introduce some parameters which make you land in meromorphic germs. So that's what we have here. We need it to be graded. So I skipped another thing. I never told you how the partial order fits in with the grading. I wanted to avoid technical details, but we should be wary of that. So we have our algebra. Think of cones, trees, graphs, and a target algebra. Think of meromorphic germs. The idea is we don't want to plug in meromorphic germs into a particle accelerator. We want to plug in numbers if we wanted to do something. And so we need to extract numbers from that. What does the coproduct do? The coproduct is used to build convolution product. So I don't know whether I have a pointer here, maybe. Yeah. So this thing is built from the coproduct. Remember, the coproduct used the complement map. Then these are two maps, two of these, which we combine by a tensor product. We implement this, which, remember, undid a product. So there are two components. One goes into there, one goes into there. And then we multiply the result in the target algebra of functions. And the phi i's are just two of these. So what do we do with that? The coproduct is used. This is a very brief summary of a long story. So this is due to Kohn and Kreimer, following pioneering work of Kreimer that was even earlier than that. So this phi that lands here and presents divergences, which we want to get rid of because at some point we want to have a number. What this does, this coproduct, it separates a holomorphic part from a purely meromorphic part, what we call a polar part. In doing so, it does that subtly, in a very subtle way. If you just assume you have a meromorphic function in one variable, and you say, okay, I write the Laurent expansion, I cut off the holomorphic part from the rest, and I just keep the holomorphic part and evaluate it, no problem. If you do that, then you lose locality. Then you lose multiplicativity. Having done that on a product will not be the same as having applied it to each argument of the product and then evaluated. So if you want to keep locality, you need to do something subtle like this. This star has taken care for you of undoing whatever mistake you might have done in the way I was telling you naively, just looking at what converges, keeping it, and throwing out the rest. If you do that naively, it doesn't work in one variable. And this will tell you, okay, those were not the good ones, get rid of it, it undoes it, brings up for you the hidden subdivergences, gets rid of it, and then redoes everything, recomposes for you. So this star is a recipe to take care of fake finite terms that you wouldn't have wanted, of introducing the correct counterterms. So then, having done that, so the blue is the holomorphic part. You just evaluate it, let's say, at zero, if we're concentrating on poles at zero. And this resulting renormalized map is now multiplicative. So that's what you wanted, because otherwise you're measuring different events, which in a way that if you don't do that, you're measuring them in a way that the measurements see each other, and that you don't want. So that's what this multiplicativity, these two have nothing to do with each other. The renormalized measurement should factorize because they have nothing to do with each other. Yeah.
So the question, in principle, you can form the convolution product for any algebra and any coalgebra structure on P. Is there some additional conditions, or does it always work and then also gives the same result? Or does it give different results, but kind of they in the end give the same, essentially?
So you mean, can I implement the convolution product on any coproduct on the source algebra, source space, and any product on the target space? Yes, if that's the question. Now, the grading, for it to do something, to be useful, you really have to use a grading. This is very under connectedness, the fact that there is a smallest element somehow. That's very important. Otherwise, it doesn't work. It's not, yeah. This puts a hierarchy among your subdivergences. Yeah, so there should be, this should be consistent with the grading or filtration.
But only the co-product and the multiplication.
The multiplication, there's no grading anymore if you look at one variable. So it's essentially here. Here, everything happens there. So we'll switch to there later on. But for the moment, everything happens here. Okay, so you see this is a long, this is old. And in 2000, this co-algebraic approach helped understand it conceptually. So to summarize, the complement map led to this, and this leads to that, and hence to a renormalization procedure. Okay, so what can we renormalize? We can define, remember we had a transversal complement. We had the crown complement of a tree, and we had the complement of a subgraph. With these, we can build the corresponding convolution and implement it to things which are useful in practice, namely discrete sums on cones. So you just take lattice points on a cone. So you put a lattice on your cone and take the lattice points, and then take the components of your lattice points at a certain power AI, let's say. And this is a bit like, for those who are familiar with zeta functions, a multi-zeta function, because there's a power of Ni and you're summing, and multiple zeta functions are sums on specific types of cones, which we call Chen cones. So you can renormalize these because a priori they might diverge because your cone is infinite. Similarly, you can define a zeta function on a tree. I'm not going into the details. And every time you can figure out what the grading is, here it's the dimension, here it's the number of vertices, and I haven't written it, then you can define a Feynman integral associated with a graph according to what theory you're looking at. All these things can be renormalized using the adequate coproducts.
The boosters that you've constructed are starting with the graphs.
Yes,
it's set inclusion, and the grading that you have, the graded algebra that you construct, is that also from set inclusion, or that's something?
It should be compatible, but it's compatible, but it's given by the, you could say, for example, the number of loops in your graph. So it's a perturbative point of view, very perturbative, contrary.
So the infinities that you get, just the infinities that you have. At this level, it looks completely abstract, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You're looking at a field theory by making this map on.
That's right.
And so on.
Yes. And so.
I'm not sort of seeing where the infinite,
Because in the Feynman integral, which I haven't written out for you.
Okay, so yeah?
It's in that map. The infinities are in this map. Yeah, in the fact that all these maps will land in meromorphic germs, they're not holomorphic. So the poles reflect the infinities.
Okay.
We'll go back to that.
You could have a theory, for example, abstractly, without any such infinities, right? I'm just saying.
You could, yes. If everything goes well, you could have
sure.
Just.
You're saying now you map it onto theories we know where you.
Yes, and you expect poles.
Thank you.
Okay, so now another point of view. So here we had meromorphic germs in one variable. Now we're going to introduce several parameters, complex parameters. Namely, we're going to over-regularize in a sense, for example, for a Feynman graph, we're going to regularize every loop or even worse, link between two vertices, okay? this is somehow over-regularizing, and we will have, instead of one parameter as we said we would have here, we'll have infinitely many. Okay, so what is a locality relation? So we're going to, now instead of going to co-products, we're going to remember that these new parameters come from different sources, again, with locality in at the back of our mind. The Z-i's we're going to introduce come from different events. And we need for that an abstract, again, an abstract locality relation, which we also call independence relation. So it's a very easy symmetric binary relation. Kasia, in a recent preprint, generalized that to a non-symmetric one, which you can symmetrize, which is closer to causality. So you can do that. You can adapt things. So here it's just a symbol to say two things are different. But if you look at the definition, equality is a symmetric binary relation. So you think it's a bit strange. It's not separating anything. But it'll soon be ruled out. So we can keep it for the moment. It won't serve our purpose, but we don't need to throw it out from the beginning. So think of the T is a bit like a orthogonal the other way. Think of replacing it by orthogonality. Think of orthogonality as one of these relations, separating. It's a good thing to have in mind. And then a bit like an orthogonal complement, we can define independence or polar set to our to a subset U of X. So it's like set theory with an additional T, which is a separating device, if you want to think it this way. For example, disjointness. So you see, we're very close to our complements, but now we view it a little differently. A symmetric relation and orthogonality, the one we already had. So again, we're very close to our complements. But there's also probability, and this is reassuring because we are wanting to deal with measures. We do want to define path integrals. So, and indeed, it's the same idea that two independent events are measured independently. Number theory, coprime. This is also very useful, transversal manifolds. When you think of wavefront sets and their supporting manifolds, this is useful to separate singularities in the micro-local setup. And this is very essential for locality, separation of support. As you see, it could be a pseudo-separation, because I'm not asking them to be disjoint, I'm asking them to be at a certain distance. If I take epsilon equals zero, it comes to disjointness. So just to say that this kind of idea is in many areas of mathematics and physics. So what does a complement have to do with locality? Well, we already saw. And you see, we can say that if we have a complement, we say that two elements are separate or independent if one is in the complement of the other or the other in the complement of the first. In practice, the or is redundant. You only need one because of involutivity of the complement in practice. But let's put it like that. Okay, so if you have a complement map, you have a locality relation. Not every locality gives you a complement map. That's something we're working on now. Prototypes, I think you might have guessed yourselves. Remember, we had the set complement, and from there we can build the disjointness locality. And this is really separating events. Orthogonality, same thing, okay? Very easy. Other examples. For cones, remember we had cones, then we say that they're independent when they're orthogonal, namely when the spaces spanned by the cones are orthogonal to each other. Note that we're using an inner product. This inner product is very important because it enters the renormalization group issue, because it's a choice. So this choice is relevant for the renormalization group. Trees, when the vertices are disjoint, the trees have nothing to do with each other, the vertices are disjoint. And then when the edges of the graphs are disjoint, if the graphs have nothing to do with each other. Usually one doesn't really consider this. For example, Kuhn and Kramer, they just take the algebra generated by graphs, but they subintend that the graphs are disjoint. And this we want here to put forward. Okay, so what do we do? What was that? Yes, so independence of probabilistic events. One event has no effect on the probability of another event, and independence of events in QFG, one object should be not only influenced by its direct surroundings. In different locations, they shouldn't influence each other. And the two are, of course, very much related if you think of path integrals. Okay, so our observables, which would be those, a cone, it's very abstract, I admit, a cone, a tree, a graph, and the measurement, which is here, and hopefully then we evaluate this meromorphic germ, because otherwise we have a germ, we don't have a number, and path integral approach to quantum field theory, this would be a path integral. And so the independence, which we're talking about here, would mean that this evaluation is multiplicative. Beware that this, well, it has to do with the convolution, but here it's more abstract. This is just a concatenation of two events, but it is related to what I was saying earlier on, that the Birkhoff-Hopf factorization factorizes thanks to this special convolution product. Okay, so this was inspired, yes, 5 minutes, thank you. This was inspired by Speer in the 70s, I think, who advocated an analytic regularization procedure in several variables. So what do? We swap the coproduct for a locality relation. So we had a coproduct here, and now we're going to put everything there. We're going to put here a locality relation, which will also impose one here. So we'll give up the coproduct and put a locality relation. Remember that both the coproduct and the locality relation use a complement map. Now, the target space, this has a price. We're introducing several complex variables. Initially, we only had one, and here we have as many as edges of the graphs, for example, as many as the vertices of a tree, as many as the, edges of a cone, for example, so many, okay? And we won't need this very sophisticated Birkhoff convolution. We'll be able to do everything naively because we were careful to separate everything and to avoid fake finite terms. So this would be a long story to explain, but I wanted to focus on the fact that using the complement map, we could, instead of building a coproduct, build a locality relation, thanks to which we can be very naive again and just take a minimal subtraction scheme, but this minimal subtraction scheme is in many variables. So this way we have a locality principle, we haven't violated it, and the renormalization, which is a minimal subtraction scheme in infinitely many variables, takes place here. It doesn't see where we come from. So it's very universal. Okay, to summarize, what did we do? We started with a complement map. We built either coproduct and used it for an algebraic Birkhoff factorization to renormalize, or alternatively, which we would advocate because we think it's, kind of avoids introducing these fake finite terms to then get rid of them. This way we never introduce them, and implement a naive multivariable minimal subtraction scheme. This was in order to cure divergences and renormalize while preserving locality. Open questions, or well, not really open, we're working on that. From a complement map, we built a locality relation. Can we go the other way? It's obvious not. For example, identity is a locality relation because it's a binary symmetric relation, and it's not separating anything, but you can introduce a few requirements which define you a one-to-one correspondence. There is a one-to-one correspondence between a class of locality relation and complement maps on finite dimensional vector spaces. On the, can you hear me?
I'm walking on it.
Can you hear me?
I'll give up. No. Sorry.
And then
it's recorded.
Yeah, okay. I've only got this line. Okay, I really didn't pass the test. I'm sorry. Okay. Complement maps and Laurent expansions. I told you that we were using a minimal subtraction scheme in many variables. This involves a Laurent theory for meromorphic germs in many variables. This is a bit subtle. And for that, we use a complement map. For example, the orthogonality to separate holomorphic from meromorphic. You can think of irreducible fraction. And the fraction involves linear forms in the denominator. And you have to decide when it's irreducible. It's irreducible when the top part is complement to the bottom part, orthogonal, whatever complement you have. So we're working on that. And so a class of complement maps ensures a splitting of meromorphic germs into the blue part, which is holomorphic, and the red part, which is what we throw away, so that we can have a minimal subtraction scheme. So a few references. You see Cohn and Keimer, 1988. I think this was wrong, 98, I think it was. And Speer, older, 67. And also, you see some integral interpolators on the Euler-Maclaurin formula for polytopes, 2012. Just to say where this leads to beyond quantum field theory. Thank you very much for your attention.
Time for a few questions. So, as several people said that this was a little bit abstract for most people. So, supposing I was giving you two theories, right? And how would they differ in your structure? The first theory is, say, just a finite theory, finite quantum field theory. You know, it could be gross number model or something like that. It's finite, just it has a non-trivial fixed point, but it's finite. The second one would be something like QE or QCE, where it is really renormalizable. And the third thing would be something like perturbative general relativity, which is not renormalizable. So what would be different here? I mean, what will you see that, you know, that sometimes you cannot subtract out infinity sometimes? So how do I see it in your structures?
So I would give it back to you, the theory. I would say, please implement a regularization on every edge of your graph and tell me whether you can find meromorphic germs with linear poles. This is a big constraint. And mostly it works. When it's not renormalizable, I suspect it doesn't work.
That was my question. So that's what will happen, you think? I mean,
yes, in general, if it's renormalizable, you expect linear poles. And that's enough. You can implement this. You can just be naive and do a minimal subtraction scheme in your many variables.
But is there a precise result which sort of relates to the normalizability with this?
Not yet, because
are examples only or what?
It would be nice to have something like it's renormalizable if and only if you have meromorphic germs with linear poles. But I don't know.
Just related to that, I mean, the structure of the graphs as well, right? I mean, the nature of graphs in one theory. I mean, in gravity, you don't expect the same kinds of Feynman graphs as you would in, say, other field theories. So even the nature of the coset looks like it would be different, right? I mean, because that's coming out of your underlying graph theoretic constructions.
Yes. So I suppose if you end up with meromorphic germs with linear bundles, I suppose the structure will be reflected in the structure of the pulp, I expect. But all this is, speculation. I really don't know.
Can I just follow up on our bias question to ask just in slightly different words again? So when you said renormalizability, I'm assuming you're referring to perturbative renormalizability.
Yes, yes, yes.
So do you have any idea what happens to theories which are renormalizable at an interacting fixed point, so which are asymptotically safe?
No, I don't know, because we haven't yet investigated that, but that would be interesting to do.
But it all have to do with this non-existence or limited existence of this.
Yes, this the structure of the germs, I think, decides a lot. But I mean, why? How to anticipate that you will end up in the meromorphic germs with linear poles? That I don't know.
Let's continue discussions at the coffee break, and let's thank Sylvie first again.